Thanks to the organizers for putting together this workshop. I find these Schubert conferences really nice. It brings together a lot of people from different backgrounds and viewpoints. That said, my talk is actually not going to have any Schubert calculus in it. So I'm going to give a basic introduction to echovariant cohomology. I'm going to talk, hopefully, my plan is to give two different definitions of echovariant cohomology, talk about various properties of the ring, and do a couple examples. That's the plan. So I have some space X, and throughout this talk, I think I'm going to just take all my spaces, all my groups to be very nice. So in particular, say X is, so I'm an algebraic dominator, so a smooth, complex, projective variety, or if you prefer, if you're more of a symplectic person, like a compact, symplectic Hamiltonian. So associated to your space, so maybe I'll just say, for me, I'll say it's a smooth, complex, projective variety. You get a cohomology ring. And now, say you have your space X actually has some more structure to it. In particular, you have a group acting on X. So here, I'll take my group to be very nice, also like a connected, compact Lie group. Maybe later it'll be just a torus. You get another ring, the echovariant cohomology ring. So what you've done is you have your space X, and now you have some extra information. You have your group action on it. This turns out to be a bigger ring. And so it's a bigger ring than the ordinary cohomology, but because it's bigger and because you have this extra structure, sometimes actually this bigger ring is easier to work with. So you get, it's easier somehow to do some computations. You can take advantage of the group action. For example, and this is a theme that will come up, you can understand this ring by somehow understanding fixed loci. This dates back to about the 80s, and I guess Megumi was talking about GKM. Gretzky called it McPherson. So this is bigger, but maybe more structured to take advantage of. So I'll just go ahead and give the first definition, and then spend some time going over the different parts of the definition of echovariant. Wow. Okay, so we take of my notation. So we have a group G, and we take EG. So EG is going to be a contractible space. With a free G action. Okay. So first I'm just going to write the definition, and then I'm going to talk about the various parts of it. So then we have BG, which is the quotient by G, the classifying space. And then we take a group action, consider a group action on this space, G acting on EG, by, just make sure, G acting on EX, E, maybe I shouldn't use E, P, E sounds like the identity. So you get an action of G on EG cross X. You get a quotient, so I'll call this XG. Quotient by this group action. The other notation that sometimes people use is EG cross GX. I might use both. So the echovariant cohomology ring, this is the definition, is just the ordinary cohomology of G. All right, so this is the definition, but it's very, let me now go through the various parts of it. So first of all, I'm going to talk about what is EG. What is this EG? And also, this is independent of choices, EG. This ring of choices, contractual spaces. What? Sorry. You take quotient by X. Thanks. Okay. So, things to talk about. What is this EG? What are the properties of this ring? And how do we compute this ring? So these are some things I'm going to touch on today. How to compute. So I'll start off with, because to define this, you have to understand what this EG is. Yeah. So there are two requirements for EG, right? So EG has to be has a free G action. It's up here a bit. And it has to be contractible. It's supposed to be contractible. Okay. So the first thing I'll say is that you know, sometimes you can find a space that has you take your G, some torus, or some other group, and you can find a space that has a free G action in it, but it might not be actually contractible. So the way, let me just state the following fact, right, that you can sort of get around the first requirement. You can sort of get around having the second requirement, that actually be contractible. So the following fact. So let's say for n bigger than 0, if the principal G bundle EG is, I guess the term is N connected. So this means that basically I'm trying to say that E is not necessarily contractible, but it's close to being contractible. So FM, the sphere, M dimensional sphere to E is contractible for all M less than or equal to N. So this is, you're approximating, it's not, E, you think of E as sort of like EG, except it's not really contractible, but it's close to being contractible. Then, your Mth cohomology group, if you construct it using E instead of EG, E.
Second one.
Oh, I'm sorry. E to B. That's just the quotient. Yeah, good idea. Thanks. E tensor G. Okay. For M less than or equal to N, dimension of X less than N. So in other words, the idea is that you can calculate the cohomology, you can approximate the cohomology using an approximately contractible space. It doesn't have to be completely contractible.
You don't want,
yeah.
You don't want,
oh, I'm sorry.
Like,
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I'm sorry. Early in the morning. Okay. Right. So you can approximate the equivariant cohomology of your space X by using this not quite contractible space. So let me do the first example. So EG. I guess this is not the same as capital EG. Example. Take G to be S1 or you can take C star. You get the same. You get the same ring. So I want to understand all this, the EG for the G, because that's one. And then, right, so I need to, in order to see what EG can be, I need it to have a free S1 action and at least close to contractible. So what has a free S1 action? Well, GX freely, S1X freely on the sphere. Qn minus 1 sitting inside. Yeah. So this action is just by scalars by scalar multiplication. And the quotient is CP. Okay. So this is the situation I have. I want an EG. So I have. Thank you. So what I have here is S2n minus 1 over CP n minus 1. I have this candidate for EG, S2n minus 1, but it's not contractible, right? But I have a free action on it. And this is actually 2n minus 2 connected. Okay. But it's close to being contractible. So I can use this fact here. So I want to understand ES1. As I take my n to be larger and larger, I can take the limit of the Sn minus 1s, S2n minus 1s, S infinity, being a little floppy here, and BS1's a quotient. So this is a contractible, this is a contractible. In particular, HS1 of a point, right, this is exactly ES1, but the definition, sorry, BS1. And I have CP infinity, this is a polynomial ring, I'll use R coefficient, in one variable, one for each CP k. In one degree, you have t to the k for where degree of t is 2. The cells are the spheres, the CP case. So maybe as a second example, if you take G to be, instead of the one-dimensional torus, M-dimensional torus, you can take, so this is called T. ET is, just by analogy, S infinity to the M, CP is CP infinity to the M. And you get the cohomology, the torus-equivalent cohomology of a point to be the cohomology of BT. And now you have a generator for each of these. So you get a polynomial ring in M variables corresponding to the different copies of CP infinity. Okay. So that's the equivalent cohomology of a point. And this is somehow one of the crucial facts about the differences between ordinary cohomology and equivalent cohomology, is that in ordinary cohomology, the cohomology of a point is just a one-dimensional vector space, and here it's a ring already. It's infinite dimensional. Okay. So far what we've, in terms of equivalent cohomology, all we've done is equivalent cohomology of a point when the group is a torus. But this is somehow very important, and the very important case. You somehow get a lot of information by looking at equivalent cohomology using a torus and the point. So let me just say a couple words about both of those things. We have the following proposition. So G is again connected compact Lie group. We have a maximal torus. You have the vowel group. And you have a action of G on your space X. Then the Eckhoff-Wren cohomology, the G Eckhoff-Wren cohomology of X, right, is actually the T Eckhoff-Wren cohomology of X, the part that's fixed by the vowel group. So in other words, somehow the torus is actually, if you know the torus, you can get the G Eckhoff-Wren cohomology. So it's not, when you see, later on, when you're seeing all this Eckhoff-Wren cohomology stuff, you'll probably see a lot of T Eckhoff-Wren cohomology, and this somehow explains our fascination with the toroid, or how you can reduce things to the torus. Okay. And then, so that's reducing G to the torus, and then I'll say a lot more about reduction to the point a bit later. Okay. So I want to go over some facts and some maps that you get and some properties you get out of them that you can at least see a hint of. Okay. Let me just say we have some projection maps. So we have this EG cross X. We have two projections, one down to EG, one down to X. And then if we take the quotient by G everywhere, we get this XG, get X mod G, get BG. Okay. So this is just the projection maps in both directions. And call this map the projection pi and this map sigma. So, in facts, right. So, right. We get from these projections, so one, we get a homomorphism. We get two homomorphisms, one from pull back here and one from pull back here on cohomology. But let me just say, we get a homomorphism pi upper star from the point, equivalent cohomology of a point, which is BG, the ordinary cohomology of BG by definition, to the equivalent cohomology of X, which is by definition the ordinary cohomology of XG. Okay. This gives the equivalent cohomology of X the structure of an HG star of a point module. We just say that, in particular, well, maybe another fact. Just say, in fact, you get. Well, this is when X is nice, as I said at the beginning, and T is X nicely and linearly. Here, in fact, for X nice. You actually get this is a vector space. Yeah. So in other words, if you're looking for a basis, often a basis for this cohomology, it'll be a basis it can be indexed by basis elements in here. Yeah.
You mean that identification as a vector space?
Yeah, as a vector space. No, as a vector
not
space. No, definitely not. It's a vector space. And furthermore, you can recover the ordinary cohomology. So you recover this by setting the t's equal to 0. So I just want to point out that if you're interested in, what you're interested in is the ordinary cohomology, you can recover it from the Echeverian cohomology. It's a bigger ring, and in fact, you can recover the ordinary ring. Yeah. So maybe I should just say. Yeah, it's a ring map. Yeah, I'll say something like this. It won't be big. All right. So the other map we have is the sigma. Let me tell you what some of the things you can see from that. I'll just make a remark that the fiber of sigma of, well, an element in the orbit space is actually bgx, where gx is the stabilizer of x. In g. Okay. In particular, if g acts freely on x, you don't have stabilizer, right? Then actually, this sigma upper star, this homomorphism, from the Echeverian cohomology, sorry, from the ordinary cohomology of the quotient to the Echeverian cohomology of X is actually an isomorphism. Is an isomorphism. Okay. So when G acts freely, you actually just get the ordinary cohomology of the quotient. And this is somehow actually the what's happening in the construction of the definition of the Echeverian cohomology ring, right? So G doesn't act necessarily freely on X, right? So what we do is we modify, so this is just a note, in the definition we modify X to EG cross X, and then it acts freely here because it acted freely on EG. This is sort of why you do that. One motivation for doing that construction. In construction. And one more map, and then I'll list a bunch of properties of the ring. We have this projection map to BG. And the fiber over the baseline, so the fiber to say X is the fiber over the baseline of GG. So you get an inclusion here. Inclusion of fiber. So again, inclusion X into XG. Okay. Gets another homomorphism. Let me just use this map here. This actually, I mean, this gives you a lot of functoriality. And this allows us to actually extend lots of concepts in ordinary cohomology to like a variant cohomology. One thing I want to just point out here. Right. So if you're looking at the fiber over the base point is X, and you get the ordinary cohomology of that fiber. You can sort of think of the equivariant cohomology, the whole equivariant cohomology ring, as the rest of the fibers, as encoding information about the rest of the fibers. So over the base point, you get X, and somehow the equivariant cohomology encodes the cohomology of XG, so it includes all the other fibers. So that's one way of thinking about it. So let me just list a bunch of properties about this equivariant cohomology. So you get a lot of functoriality, and you can extend, and that's what I mean by extend, I guess, that you have the ordinary cohomology of X, and you're extending to all of XG, all the properties you want. Equivariant cohomology. So you get functoriality. Basically, you get almost everything you would want. Right. You have push-forwards and pullbacks. Get excision and Kunneth. You get Poincaré duality when you expect it, when it's nice and turn classes, etc. So equivariant cohomology is a cohomology theory. It's bigger than the ordinary cohomology theory, but it satisfies a lot of the properties you want in a cohomology theory. Okay. All right. So this is the definition, Borel's mixing construction definition of equivariant cohomology, and we computed it for a torus, when G is a torus, and X is a point so far. Okay. So now I'm going to shift gears and give a different definition of equivariant cohomology. I'm not going to show that they're equivalent or anything. I just want to introduce it because I think it's nice and hands-on. So this is via equivariant homology. So I'm going to define equivariant homology first and then define equivariant cohomology. This is somehow more topological. Okay. So if I'm going to define homology, I want to understand classes or cycles. So an equivariant I cycle. Right. Consists of data, a free G space, so a space with a free G action on it, E. It's a quotient by that G action. And this is supposed to be a of dimension I. And P is actually, the definition is actually a pseudo manifold. I'm just sort of ignore that. It's like a manifold. Okay. And a diagram. In the diagram. Right, so ordinarily you think of cycles as living inside X, but now it's just a map from E to X and keeping track of the quotient. And this is the thing, P is the thing of dimension I. Let's do an example. So let's take X to be S1 cross S1, torus, and T to be S1. Okay. So my space X is this guy here. This is X. My torus is acting by rotating it this way. So let's say first I want a zero cycle. What is an example of a zero cycle on X? And sometimes you might just abuse notation, say P is a I cycle on X. So what's a zero cycle? Well, P is a point, and my E is S1. So the S1 acts freely on S1 here, my rotation. It's this guy here. And then I get my zero cycle. Okay, so that's a zero cycle in X. What's a one cycle? An equivariant zero cycle. What's a one cycle? Well, I have this diagram, the whole torus. This is a one cycle. Right. Now, we need to talk about when two cycles are equivalent. And the equivalence I'm going to take on these cycles is by cobordism. It's basically the concept, the ordinary cobordism concept in topology. I'll just illustrate by example. So cobordism means that you have an extra dimension so that the boundary is, if you have two cycles, then the boundary is the difference of the two. So I'll illustrate a cobordism by example. Between two zero cycles. So I have my zero cycles there. Get some colors. So I have this zero cycle. Gives me this guy here. I have another zero cycle. I should have drawn this as a. This is this. Okay. I have another zero cycle here. Right. And the cobordism would include something in between. So this is an example of a cobordism. The boundary is exactly the difference of those two zero cycles. Is that clear? What I mean? I'm not giving formal definitions here. I just want to give an idea. Okay. So the definition of the homology, the equivariant homology, is that this is a set of cobordism classes, so equivalence classes under this equivalence of equivariant I cycles. Okay. And this is an abelian group. How do you make it into an abelian group? So minus P is the P with the opposite orientation. And P1 plus P2 is the union. Okay. This gives you an abelian group structure on the homology, the covariant homology groups defined. All right. So in the case we just described, of course I'm not justifying why those aren't cobordinate to zero, and why those are the only ones, but in this case, if you believe that these are the only class, these represent the only classes of cobordism, cobordism classes of equivariant 0 and 1 cycles, you get the homology, the equivariant homology of S1 cross S1. So, for example, H not S1, sorry, of T of S1, S1 cross S1, in this example, is one-dimensional, and this is one-dimensional. And that's all you have, actually. There's nothing in higher degree. And notice, so the remark I want to make here, that this is actually, this torus action here was actually a free action, right? This was a free action. And we talked about free actions of S1, of this of S1 of T, and you get, and actually, you get what you expected, which is that it should be the ordinary homology of the quotient. So you have real numbers in degree 0 and 1, as expected. I know we talked about cohomology, but the homology part. Okay. So that's equivariant homology. These definitions are the cycles, and I tell you which ones are equivalent. Then I form the abelian group. Now, for equivariant cohomology, I dualize. So the definition of equivariant cohomology, let me first define it as a vector space. As a vector space, and then I have to tell you what the multiplication is. Equivariant cohomology is defined as just a vector space dual to the equivariant homology. So, in other words, it's hom of the group into R. So that's as a vector space, and the multiplication, how do I define the multiplication? Well, I have, with multiplication, defined, given by dualizing. So I'll just write the homology, and you can dualize the following diagram. I have, in homology, I have the equivariant homology of X, the adjacent equivariant homology of X, and I get a map, an isomorphism, to the equivariant homology, I plus J, G cross G, X cross X. And I get a map, H, I, J, X, given by a diagonal. So this diagonal sends G to G and X to XX. Okay. So if you dualize everything, you get a map from, you get a multiplication map the other way for the cohomology. This is homology. Yeah. So dualizing, you get by via the isomorphism also. Okay. Yeah.
Does that multiplication actually give you the usual level of multiplication on equivariant?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So this recovers. The two definitions are both of the same ring in the end. Okay. So let's try to compute at least something using this definition. So let's take as our first example one that we've already done. We take again x as a point, and then I promise we'll do at least one thing that's not x equals a point. At least try. Okay. So I need to know what my cycles are, my equivariance. I'm going to first look at homology and then look at the cohomology. So the homology is given by these equivariant I cycles. And what are my equivariant I cycles? It actually looks familiar. It's these 2k plus 1, I guess, to the point. So this is my p, this is my e, and this is my p. So what is this? This is the definition of a k cycle, a 2k cycle rather. Right. So you get, for every even integer, you get for every 2k, you get a 2k cycle. This is an example of a 2k cycle. And I haven't shown this, and I'm not going to, but in fact, these are all non-zero 2k cycles. And in fact, they generate the homology. There are no other cycles. There are no other, you can really see the 2k cycle. So I'll even write, it's generated by the CPK. So this is 0 to 5. And what's the dual of this? The dual of this is, again, is again polynomial running in one variable, where the one t squareds are dual to these guys. Similarly, I guess you can do similarly. Well, you also get the equivalent cohomology of a higher dimensional torus. Okay. Let's do one example where maybe something, it's not a point. Let me do this example of the two-sphere. So, especially if you prefer. Take x to be my 2-sphere and t to be s1. So here's my 2-sphere, x. Right. And I'm going to act on this by rotating around the equator, so we're rotating on this axis. So so far, actually, I mean, we've only done a torus and a point. And in those cases, you just get this freely generated ring. In this case, we're actually going to get a relation. So I'm not going to prove much about this, but I want to at least get to the point where we see a relation. Okay. This is your t acting this way. So first note that we have two fixed points. Right? We have north and the south pole. North and south poles are the fixed points. Okay. So in homology, you get an inclusion, you get a map from the fixed points to the fx. We have this. And I want to give an example of a relation. That's what I want to do first. Okay. So we have a relation in degrees 0. So I'm looking at zero cycles. So what zero cycles do I have? I have, what's an example of a zero cycle? And first I'm just going to concentrate on the north and the south poles even. So here's an example of a zero cycle, right? That's a zero cycle. Another zero cycle, given by this guy. Zero cycle. Right. So what zero cycle is this? Right. So this is a zero cycle. This is the zero cycle corresponding to CP0, as we've just seen up here, or, up there. This is the class of CP0 at the North Pole. This is the class of, this gives the class of CP0 at the South Pole. And the there you get a relation because there's a cobordism between these two. And the cobordism is just given by, this is a cobordism in the middle. So you get a cobordism between these two zero cycles, which gives, use the same color, a relation CP0SN is equal to CP0S. Pardon? Yeah, you shrink the circle. Okay. So this gives this relation in, in here, and gives the relation. So let's dualize. So actually, that just shows a relation, and I'm going to just state without proof that, in fact, that's basically the only relation. So in other words, so this is a proposition. In fact, this is the only relation. So if you want, and everything is, you can get everything out of the North and the South Pole. So I'll just say, if you have, you're looking at the equivalent homology of the north and south, just the two points, mapping into the, mapping to the equivalent homology of the two-sphere, you actually get a short exact sequence R, just a one-dimensional thing, just from this relation. And this short exact sequence is given by the map sending 1 to 1n minus 1s. Oops, sorry. CP, I've gotten ahead of myself. Doesn't make any sense yet. Okay. So this is saying something pretty strong. It's saying that all the other homology groups, except for the zeroth homology group, are actually isomorphic. And then dualizing, you get a map to an equivalent cohomology. And the map here is given by sending, this is a map that takes 1n, 1s. Right? So this is a reminder that this is actually two copies of polynomial rings. So let's say it this way. Right. And this map
this short exact sequence is the map that takes the constant, the one polynomial to one. So what does this say, if you believe these various steps, that those are, this is some of the only cobordism of the obvious cycles, and that this is, everything can be gotten from these two fixed points. So the conclusion is, well, how can I write, if I'm interested in the equivariant cohomology of S2, how can I write it? Well, it includes into this pair of polynomials, so it's pairs of polynomials that satisfy a certain condition, and the condition is that f of 0 equals g of 0. Okay. So this is an example of calculating the equivariant cohomology as something that's not a point. And this is a somehow theme that maybe you'll see later. Not sure. Yeah. So, definitely. So, let me just end with a fact. Right. You notice here, this situation is not a coincidence. It's actually something that you'll see later today. And in general, say, I have, so X again is some nice space. I'm not saying how nice. T again is a torus X, nicely, linearly. And the fact is that if you have finally many fixed points, right, then you actually get this, what is called the localization map, what people call the localization map, from the inclusion of your fixed point locus into X, you get a map of equivariant cohomology, an inclusion into the equivariant cohomology of the fixed point locus, which is the just a bunch of polynomials, right? And the problem, right, so you know it includes into, you're interested in equivariant, T equivariant cohomology of X, which then gives you G equivariant cohomology. You have a bigger G acting. And the problem is always how to calculate the image. And that's what the GKM stuff helps you do. What's the image? Calculate the image. To actually find out. And it's really nice. It's just sitting inside tuples of polynomials to actually write down what the image is. OK, so I think I'll end there. Good place to end.